KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today I'm excited to have on a Fordham Law Professor Ethan Lieb, author of the book Friend vs. Friend, The Transformation of Friendship and What the Law Has to Do with It. This is a book that is I think, extremely timely. I mean, obviously, because of the explosion of social media and the use of the word and idea of friend being center to the operations of our primary social networking service, Facebook, but indeed the idea of friend and having been used as soon as innovators realized that the internet was a place where people actually could communicate and meet each other, and so antecedents of Facebook like Friendster and MySpace and other websites all went at this idea of establishing online personas and creating online networks of friends. In Friend versus Friend, Ethan takes a look at the regulation of friendship, and in other words, what the law and what regulators can do to encourage or discourage human friendships, which is something that is a fascinating topic, not just from a technological perspective, but more broadly from a perspective of social engineering. What role should the law and the government have in supporting or not supporting certain types of friendships, certain types of relationships, and indeed, what can the law do about it? Now, when I was reading through Ethan's book, as someone that teaches contracts, I opened the book and immediately thought, well, contracts play a big role here. Contracts deal directly with human interactions, with the efforts by humans or entities represented by humans attempting to achieve certain goals through private ordering. That's something that I teach in the first week of contracts when I teach it to first-year law students. And so I was certainly interested to see how contract played a role here, but of course the book goes well beyond contracts into a variety of other areas where we think about relationships. In particular, Ethan's book focuses on both duties and responsibilities of friends to establish a couple of very interesting points. As Ethan will talk about, the book opens up the door to the question of whether we should have law and government regulating friendships. And then more specifically, as Ethan points out in his introduction, he wants to point out, and as he writes, I want to convince the reader that our laws, legal institutions, and public policy agendas should be oriented towards promoting and facilitating friendships. And so it's a fascinating idea that, as Ethan points out in the book, might be repugnant to some, but something that needs to be thought about. Should government have this role? Should the law have this role? And what should it look like if it does? So I'm excited to have Ethan on to discuss this issue, again, not just from a technological perspective, but more broadly from a sociological perspective, as so much of what we talk about in Hearsay Culture involves human communications by virtue of the internet and its antecedents and what that means for our society, hence the name Hearsay Culture. So I'm excited to have Ethan on, who is joining us from his office at Fordham Law via Skype. He is a professor there, having previously taught at Hastings Law School. Ethan is joining us today on November 7th. Thank you for joining us in Hearsay Culture.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave.
Ethan, let's start off with a question that I ask most of my authors, which is the genesis of your interest in this topic, in friendships, and a bit more about your background and how you got there.
Sure. I mean, sort of a long autobiographical story that probably readers won't be all that interested in, but the short of it is in graduate school, I did a PhD in political theory and got very interested in some history of political theory involving Aristotle, Montaigne, and Cicero, some of the great classical theorists of friendship, and kind of got distracted, as it were, by democratic theory a little bit. And as I moved into my legal education, it seemed more natural to pursue, on the public law side, dimensions of democratic theory for my graduate school education. But I had always known I wanted to get back to friendship. The kind of more personal story is one that just relates to my sense as I was kind of growing up and coming of age that my sort of family background was such that I felt that friendship was where it was at for me in my intellectual development and in my emotional development. And I really thought that I wanted to focus a lot of intellectual energy on understanding what these relationships were doing for me, and then more systemically what they do for people throughout society, and try to understand whether there's any role for politics or law within that that kind of very private, intimate sphere. We traditionally think of the family as the most important and most impermeable core of the private sphere. And yet, we are okay with the government and politics routinely taking positions on how we ought to organize our familial life. And it occurred to me that we didn't have quite the same level of discourse about whether there was any role for law or politics to be engaged in other dimensions of our intimate and private sphere. There was a time, of course, when the economy was thought of as the private sphere, and of course we regulate that. And so really just struck me as deeply perplexing and as one of the interesting problems that hadn't been sufficiently thought through, what role there may be for thinking about public institutions and the private sphere of friendship. I think this is really, this book at least is a first pass at a Pandora's box of fascinating questions. I don't think I have a singular answer that I want to impose on the reader other than think about this problem and try to understand why it is that with our familial structures changing, our patterns of intimacy changing, we haven't similarly changed the way the law approaches our intimate sphere. We certainly fixate on the family in our legal system. We don't do the same about friendship, and I'm asking why that is.
And I think that Pandora's box you referred to, I think I want to explore for a moment. How do you orient this book and friendship in that broader Pandora's box, however you define it?
The Pandora's box, I think, is really that I suspect people have an immediate discomfort. I mean, as you were even speaking in your introduction about social engineering, this is exactly, I think, what people immediately think as they worry about the project, even at its commencement. They think, what is this guy doing? I mean, I don't want the law anywhere near my friendships. I don't want politics anywhere near my friendships. This is the one thing that's pure and is able to stay free of this instrumentalized reasoning that is so central to politics and law. And I think that's a completely reasonable and appropriate kind of resistance to have from the get-go. And indeed, I think it explains why it is that most people haven't bothered to head down this road. There's a very interesting and famous book by a sociologist named Viviana Zelizer at Princeton called The Purchase of Intimacy. And she means a very interesting double meaning. I was going to do the French version of that, but I'm going to stick with English. A double meaning. Right. So from one perspective, she says, look, intimacy really has this purchase over us. Intimacy is something we really prize and want to protect and want to keep the public sphere from making incursions into. And yet, as we also know, the purchase of intimacy, puts forward the salience of the fact that anything can be commodified, even intimacy. Right? You can buy sex, you can regulate marriages, you can regulate who can have children, you can regulate reproductive technologies, and indeed, you might even consider the idea of the regulation of friendship. And I think that part of the project, at least a premise of it, is to take a position on the question about whether friendship is really just about complete free choice or whether there are dimensions of social stratification that is an overlay in how we are able to engage in the practice of friending, as it were. And I mean that in its real sense, that is, in actually performing acts of friendship. Is there a background against which we are functioning that is not just socially stratified, but politically stratified, not just politically stratified, but legally stratified? That is, are there ways in our societies organized and regulated that create the kinds of friendships that we have? We think about them as completely free and almost in a naturalistic sense. Right? Our friendships are pure and they are completely free chosen and they come from nowhere but our hearts and minds. But I think that's a kind of a slightly naive view. I think that just as almost any choice we make, as we think about merit, as we think about decisions about whom to hire, as we think about decisions about what to do with our lives, heavily structured not only by where we came from, how we were brought up, but also by the opportunities available to us through the political and legal system.
With regard to this subtitle of your book, you refer to the transformation of friendship, and I actually just want to take that up initially before I get to the following part of your subtitle with regard to what the law has to do with it, which is an interesting phrase in and of itself because it opens the question rather than answering it. Let's talk about that transformation, and perhaps it ties back into your own personal experience, as you mentioned at the beginning. What is that transformation as you see it?
Yeah, well, you have to always be careful with titles because titles are not often created by the authors.
Right.
Titles are routinely products of negotiation with editors and marketers. So the transformation of friendship, in some sense, is a play on Giddens' famous book, The Transformation of Intimacy. And the idea, though, was to call to mind an important debate going on in sociology about whether friendship is actually in decline. And this is a highly contested issue within the domain of sociology, and so I don't want to say for sure I know that friendship is in decline, but there is some evidence suggesting that people have fewer people with whom they confide in, they have fewer people with whom they discuss important matters, and overall their core networks of close human connection are getting smaller and smaller. Now, that may be right, that may be wrong. It's obviously a very hard empirical question to answer, and of course you have to ask, well, when did you start keeping track of how many people each individual thinks they have as close friends? So obviously, we only have data from, so 30, 40 years. So it's not easy to know exactly how to characterize the pattern change, if there is one. But there is some evidence that friendship is on the decline. No one knows exactly why, but I doubt it's only because of law. It's also because of TV, and it's also because potentially we can now shop indoors, and so we no longer need to go into the public square to encounter one another. And certain features of technology, I would suggest, probably erode certain ideas about friendship, which we can talk about in a moment. The other dimension is actually something that I talked about before, and that is just friendship is, in some sense, and this is a kind of a counterpoint, as it were, to the first, friendship is becoming more central to how many people are organizing their lives. So that's it is on the decline if what you are looking at, say, is quantity, but if you look at the kind of core of the way people organize their family lives, and now I'm thinking about family broadly construed, not family in the conventional sense of a person you marry and then the children you have with them. Right? So that's a sort of conventional 1950s model, but I think people are more and more organizing their intimate spheres without marriage, within domains that we would consider plausibly friendship. And those sea changes in self-organization may require some attention from how our legal system and political system handle this change.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to take us to the second part.
Yeah, please. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. That was going to be my next question.
I think that's where you were headed.
Yep, that worked.
And I guess if I had my druthers in the traditional lawyerly way, I probably would have written what, if anything, the law has to do with it, not to answer the question, because I have no idea. It's very hard to know whether the law has anything to do with those transformations.
Right.
And very hard to figure out what the causal mechanisms are by which the law is engaged in somehow eroding friendship. But what I try to do in the book is explore different ways in which the law might take more notice of this fact about human self-organization and try to do something by way of providing an edifice or support or scaffolding for those relationships in a way that could help support them and help them function a little bit better. And obviously any design project of this kind has to be very, very modest about what it can plausibly hope to accomplish. So in the end, I think much of the book is in some sense more worried about predation on the category of friendship, then it really is going to be a source of creating huge amounts of regulation about how people are going to be friends. One thing that has arisen is a proposal that people ought to be able to sign up with the state to be friends so that the state knows your friends, and so that the state then treats you with the legal perks and disadvantages that would accrue to friendship. And in this way, we would be much more voluntaristic about it because only people who sign up would get this treatment. But I think that, you know, that has very little to do with friendship. That's creating what I would say is some kind of weird, newfangled institution where you have to sign up with the state to be friends. It enhances the sort of contractual nature of friendship, as it were, because then you could say these two individuals have actually entered some kind of formal arrangement by which the law now may come to them and treat them differentially. Mm-hmm. That doesn't appeal to me as a solution. I don't think creating a new institution that isn't friendship, that is something, you know, weird and state-oriented, is exactly what I'm after. But it's more a question of how to have the legal and political system kind of come to what is an organic mode of self-regulation.
We're chatting with Professor Ethan Lieb of Fordham Law, author of the book Friend Versus Friend, The Transformation of Friendship and What the Law Has to Do with It, on Hearsay Culture and KZSU FM Stanford. Ethan, as you're giving that answer, it occurs to me that there is one more fundamental bedrock question to ask, which of course is how you define a friend. And you go through, we'll spend a little time on it later, the details of what those rights and responsibilities are. But perhaps, given this transformation that you're talking about, how would you at the first top level define a friendship?
Well, of course, you have to read chapter one.
Yes.
because I concede, of course, the point that in order to get this project off the ground, you do need to have some kind of working definition of friendship, and I think that's kind of impossible to ignore. However, this is not a way of avoiding the question. I mean, I'm happy to list for you the 10 or 11 attributes that I think are common within friendships: a perception of voluntariness, a certain kind of intimacy, trust, solidarity, certain kind of exclusivity, a commitment to reciprocity, emotional warmth, mutual assistance, duration over some time, a sense of equality, enabling conflict and modalities of conflict resolution. I mean, so that, we can kind of specify what I mean by all of those, buzzwords. But I think the point to understand is that I do think that there's a cultural conception of what a friend is that enables the project to get off the ground in the first instance. But more importantly, once you are open to the possibility that particular issue areas within the law and policy thinking ought to be thinking about it, you then realize you can have differentiated definitions of friendship for those particular areas. So one of the areas I look at in the book is like the law of fiduciary duty. So in the context of fiduciary duties, we would not want to impose fiduciary duties on just any casual acquaintance. We would not want to impose fiduciary duties on people who are, workmates who see each other day to day but really have no interest in seeing each other outside of work. They're just, the people who fill your day. Important for your functioning. Without friends at work, I would be miserable, so they contribute to my happiness. But I think there's a conventional idea within our employment environment that there is something transactional about what we're doing. But, I have friends from Hastings who I continue to keep in touch with, and many people whom I no longer talk to with any regularity. They're nice people. I like them. I enjoyed seeing them day to day, but it would be very hard-pressed to call them friends, right? They were coworkers with whom I had a certain kind of relationship. And so I think the point I'm trying to make is that when you enter a particular domain or policy space, it's then that you kind of understand what the reasonable parameters of defining friendship are. You would only want to impose, if you did at all, strong fiduciary obligation, that is, duties of unselfishness, duties of loyalty, duties of not engaging in any conflicted transactions, upon only the closest type of friends. And so while you would still have available to you the kind of list of 11 important features of friendship, really what you're trying to target in those contexts is only a very, very special kind of friendship. By contrast, if you were interested in simply keeping networks together. So there's some famous experiments where people are removed from high-density poverty areas and transplanted to low-density poverty areas, better, you know, the idea being that they are moving to a community where they will have more opportunity. In those contexts, I think policy sensitivity towards friendship would enable people to understand why it was that those individuals who were being moved and transplanted and exported from their communities were sort of not able to integrate into their new communities well. You had plucked them away from their community of care and their social network. Right? In that context, it wouldn't really matter how close the friendships were. The core point of it is even there, coworkers would matter. If you no longer were able to interact with the people that sustain you day to day, it is no wonder that you're not going to feel particularly politically involved or particularly civically engaged in your new community. So in that context, we wouldn't really need to say, oh, I need a strict definition of friendship because otherwise it's going to be over-inclusive. And right? So, again, the issue area is going to, I think, do a lot of the work in helping define the contours of the kind of friendship we care about.
And I think that point gets to, of course, the focus of hearsay culture being primarily technology and intellectual property, the role of social media. Clearly, social media has put this word, friend, into millions and millions of people's minds in a way that was different than prior to social media, where you have friends that are really people you haven't spoken to in 20 years, but are now your friends because you have decided to click a button. And it's changed our notion of friendship, where I have students, for example, who ask me or send me a request on Facebook to be friends, and I tell them I am not your friend until you graduate. And so it changes and forces these interactions, as you're talking about in the book, may be awkward. Up front, what is the role of social media in the study that you've conducted in Friend versus Friend, and more broadly in our conception of friendship?
Well, it's a great question. I guess to your listenership, I will seem like one of those stodgy Luddites because I refuse to join Facebook.
That was going to be my question if you were on it. Yeah.
In part, it's because this may just show my own quirkiness, but in part, my frustration with social media is precisely what I think of as supporting networks of false friendship. And so I'm one of those guys that, you know, you read articles and articles about how this is not real friendship and they are just trading on the notion of friendship. And I think it's extremely manipulative. I mean, you're right. Social media has really tried to use the term in a way to make us feel like this is where real life is happening. This is where something intimate is happening. This is where I want to share details, right? But of course, from the corporation who's encouraging you to share those details perspective, what are they really trying to promote? Your well-being, your eudaimonia, your human flourishing, which is what we think of as friendship's core goals. Not at all, right? Well, in fact, they just want your information, right? And are using friendship as a kind of strategy to get you to do so. Now, I'm overstating it, and I think there's a concept within the sort of sociology of social media called media multiplexy. And the thought there is, well, look, if I speak to you regularly and I speak to you on the phone, then I'm going to also Twitter with you and I'm also going to engage in Facebook with you. And, you know, it's going to only enhance our relationship. It just creates another opportunity for us to engage and be close and be intimate. And, of course, that's possible. Surely my closest friends I email with. I don't think emailing with them derogates from the experience of friendship. Indeed, during the day, I speak to my friends on the phone all the time. I want to stay in communication with them. So, I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing to set up an architecture that facilitates and enables us to continue real friendships. But I do, I guess, have some worry that the notion of friendship is being diluted by, and now I'll put them in quotation marks, friending practices. You just collect as many people as you can, and you know you get as public as you can about every detail of your life, to this broad network. Indeed, what we see, at least among the legal academy, and this is watching over people's shoulders, so I see how other people use Facebook. It's not by first-person observation. But, you know, it becomes just another network for the promotion of reputational capital. It is a way people promote themselves and engage in networking, right? So social network is networking. Anyway, I mean, I'm sure your viewers are already rolling their eyes at this kind of very skeptical way of looking at this world. But I confess, from the outside, I see it as a big waste of time, and indeed takes me away from sitting with my friends in a room talking, which I still I am that guy who still prioritizes that kind of hanging out.
Well, yeah, it's funny because the show focuses on technology, but I don't certainly advocate a myopic view of technology. And in fact, I've had people on whose views of technology would make yours seem utopian. Mm-hmm. So I don't mean to suggest that the audience itself is of a single view, although there are many people who have both been on the show and listened to the show who are Facebook members. I can tell you that I've had other guests on who are not. But of course, they weren't writing about friendship, so it adds an additional dimension. Let me not push back in terms of your view of the model of social media or social networking companies, because I think it's unassailable that they are seeking your data for purposes of advertising and therefore monetization. But rather the relation.
Yes, and a way of thinking about the purchase of intimacy. To go back.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And I think that's pretty uncontroversial at this point, but let me push back and ask you this question with regard to social media. Do you think that the people who are using social media to establish friendships are, because you use the word misleading, and I guess the core of my question is this: do you think that users of social media, by virtue of the use of the word friend or friendships, themselves are changing their conception of their own personal relationships? Because you have although they change regularly, you have a wide variety of privacy settings within the category of friendship on Facebook, and opportunities now to label your friend as an acquaintance, which is a somewhat, I agree, anachronistic view of friendship. But having said that, do you think that the fine graining that both social networking sites have entered into, as well as users as they become more sophisticated with this technology, would push back against this idea of being manipulated by the entity itself?
Yes, so I mean, I think that it's great. I do take up in the book a couple of interesting design experiments that the social media companies undertook to facilitate this kind of creating smaller communities within the larger networks that would approximate better the kind of small community of friends that I think is more true to the name, that actually deserves the name. But what's strange is that, I mean, I don't think for the most part users have taken up the invitation. Now that could be wrong, could just take some time for people to figure out how to use this stuff well. I think labeling people acquaintances is not exactly, you're going to alienate people, right? And I think that the designers are struggling with this. I mean, I think, I can't remember whether it was MySpace or I think it was MySpace. You had a top 10, this created loads and loads of drama within friendship networks. And so in the end, what people started doing was, instead of actually naming their 10 friends, they would just either put their families to avoid the question altogether. So it was only your brother, your sister, your mother, your father, your cousin that could enter the top 10, because you just actually didn't want to differentiate among your friend group. Or alternatively, you would put like bands there, right? So totally impersonal relationships, mm-hmm. right? So people have friendships with, Tom Cruise or what? I don't know if Tom Cruise is on social media. Seems unlikely, but anyway, or the Church of Latter-day Saints or what have you. That those would be part of your top 10, because you just didn't want to engaging in that exercise so publicly is difficult, right? I mean, I think like it's a private thing, you know, knowing exactly who your friends are, and you're not all that interested in projecting all the time, hey, these are my closest friends and you guys are really peripheral to my way of thinking about myself and my private life. So I think it's an interesting design experiment. I don't know how successful it can plausibly be. We'll see. I think these things are developing over time. Who knows whether, you know, in 3 years we'll still be talking about Facebook.
We're chatting with Professor Ethan Lieb, author of the book Friend Versus Friend, The Transformation of Friendship, and What the Law Has to Do with It, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to the show. Ethan, let's turn to another initial point, which gets into your main claims, which I do want to spend time on in this latter part of the interview. You repeat, and you mentioned it even in answering one of the questions with regard to this idea of social engineering, which I agree is a provocative term. But you talk initially in the book about it being somewhat ugly, to use your phrase, to need government and laws to prop up friendship. And again, you know, I mentioned in my introduction, as someone that teaches contracts, my initial reaction was, it doesn't seem ugly to me. In fact, it seems like we may want that. So perhaps you could describe for the listeners, for those that may not share that view, certainly, what do you see as distasteful or ugly about the law having a particular role in, to use your phrase, propping up friendship?
Well, I mean, I don't personally view it as ugly. I'm trying to respond to a kind of reaction that I am anticipating. I'm glad that you as a reader didn't experience, but many who look at me, I've given talks, and I get very strange faces. And the faces are faces that approximate faces of disgust, right, which are very physical reactions. And I think that there's something about, and this goes back to something we were talking about earlier, there's something about the incursion of the public institution into something that seems so private and so impenetrable and so fundamentally tied up with our sense of personality and our sense of identity, that it is just wholly ugly. It's yucky. I don't want the law there. This is where I get to just be me. I mean, it's kind of like having, you know, the same kind of reaction we have to the government listening into our private conversations on the phone. Right? That's the sense I feel that people immediately call to mind. Of course, it's not at all what I envision. I mean, I envision much like you had a reaction. Your reaction was, look, in contract law, we sort of are engaging in the regulation of relationships all the time. So, I mean, and I, as a contracts teacher myself, I had a very similar first approach. I don't think that as a first principle, it's unacceptable to try to engage in the project of making sure people don't screw each other really badly. It seems to me that's part of what we are doing when we're policing breaches of contract. My view is this isn't all that different. And indeed, on the family law side, it seems not all that different from the reality that we allow the law to intervene in family relationships quite routinely. And we tell people how they're allowed to have families, and we tell them how they have to be constituted and how many people are allowed to participate. And we don't go as far as China and require you only have a certain number of children, but we do say marriages can be only between two people. And I mean, I assume if we were having this conversation in 10 years, we won't be basing the parameters of marriage on gender, but we do now for the most part. To me, it's quite easy to understand why we might want the law here, but I think that it's also quite reasonable to understand why people have a very different kind of reaction.
Well, I think it doesn't. I think that gets to that fine grading you were talking about, which gets us to these duties and responsibilities. Because friendship itself plays a role in different ways, depending on the context of the relationship and the goals of the relationship. And so perhaps we can talk about that a bit, because it seems to me that part of this ugliness has to do with how the issue is framed. And you frame it in terms of these two main claims, which I mentioned up front. Let's take those up now, and so perhaps you could describe in a little more detail what those two claims are.
What are my two claims? I'm trying to remember. Yeah. No, I think that really the book could be divided into two different kinds of arguments.
Yes.
One is to say, look, this is kind of happening on the ground. That is, the law is kind of involved in our friendships. It's not doing it in any systematic way. It's not doing it in any way that is like geared towards the accomplishment of any objective. It could be more organized. It could be more systematic. So the hope in the first instance is really just to show people, hey, look, this is happening. You, whether you like it or not, whether you think it's ugly or lovely, it's happening, and you need to just learn to deal with it. There's a purpose served in legal scholarship by showing people, hey, courts are doing, they see this problem over and over again. They have no law that addresses it. They just are like, you know, ad hoc decision making without any real understanding of what they're doing. And if you care about this issue in the slightest, the idea of ad hoc decision making without any rootedness in a theory or a policy objective would likely lead to bad outcomes. So I take that to be the most modest version of what I'm doing here, and I think that that's the least objectionable. The second idea that the book tries to promote is, you know what, we ought to be taking on a policy objective here. And that policy objective that we ought to be taking on is the facilitation and support of these important relationships in people's lives. And that's hugely contestable. I mean, I think the core pushing back from those who are not just disgusted, but then who have spent some time thinking about the issue, is the idea that if the law takes a position on this, we are going to crowd out people's relationships. And that's the danger. If what you do is you set up the policy objective to promote friendship, what you're actually going to most do is deter people from engaging in them or make them scared to invest in them, because they're going to realize there are all kinds of costs and penalties associated with this. So why would I want to be bothered? So that is often referred to as the crowding out effect. Okay, so those are sort of the two claims, and they relate to each other, because one is saying, look, this is happening, and we ought to have a policy objective, and then the second is, hey, here's a pretty good idea for a policy objective. I'm much less sure about the second, just to say I am not actually sure whether the kinds of thinking that I'm envisioning would or would not crowd out friendship in the real world. I'm skeptical of the crowding out claim. That is to say, I think if we took to the task of designing experiments that alleviate poverty in a way that was sensitive to people's core social networks and core friends, I find it very hard to believe that's going to crowd out friendship. Right? Indeed, I also am skeptical, because if you use the analogy to marriage, I don't think it's the case that creating a system by which we have legal recognition of certain kinds of coupling, I don't think this has created a whole lot of disincentive for people to enter into marriages. I mean, it's just that does not strike me as plausible. Similarly, I don't think if you set up a system by which people would have certain kinds of perks and disadvantages, because spouses have, you know, responsibilities to each other too, and you take on a marriage, you take on not only all of the great tax benefits, but also some pretty substantial responsibilities, some pretty substantial liabilities. And I don't think this has done much to deter or crowd out love within marriages. So similarly, I'm somewhat skeptical of the view that we're going to crowd out the possibility of people to love each other as friends if we suddenly say, you know what, if you do not disclose to your friends certain features about this product you're selling them, we're going to hold you to a liability that we wouldn't hold you to if you were mere strangers. Because within mere strangers, you're going to have, you know, the caveat emptor principle will take hold. Right, that is, you do not need to disclose. So, I mean, you know, the kinds of policies I'm envisioning, whether it's policy sensitivity to a much bigger policy agenda or whether it's little legal things like you have a duty to disclose. These are not the sort of things that I really believe will crowd out love within friendship. So I'm cautiously optimistic that the argument on the second point actually holds. I'm much more sure about the first one, which is I combed thousands of cases and found that courts were, in fact, occasionally recognizing that litigants were friends. Friend v. friend is both a reference to friends suing each other in court and also these kind of competing ideas about friendship, free choice versus social stratification, friend in the real world versus friend online. And so that's what I'm trying to accomplish with that the double meaning, as it were, of my own title. I am quite certain about what I found empirically looking at cases. On the policy side, I'm less sure, but optimistic that I've given people something to chew on and to consider further.
We're chatting with Professor Ethan Lieb, author of the book Friend Versus Friend, The Transformation of Friendship and What the Law has to Do with It, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Ethan, we're at around 10 or 12 minutes left in the show, which is what I call the unfair question portion of the show, when I ask questions that you may not be able to answer adequately in the time that we have left. But I ask the questions anyway. So let's drill down a bit on this idea of relational contracts. And I recognize that it's a theory that goes directly towards people that practice and teach in contract law, but as well as anyone that enters into contracts. So I think it has a broader swath of interest.
That's why I put it in the book. It's at the end, so readers who read the first five chapters and then just peter out, that's okay too.
There they go. They get the bonus section, as it were. But let's delve into it for a few minutes here. Explain what relational contract theory is and how it ties into your conception of friendship.
Well, the conventional idea about what relational contract theory is a focus on recognizing that for a very long time, contract law, contract doctrine, and contract theory had been organized around a basic idea that what we were trying to do when we were governing contracts was deal with parties who just show up, engage in a discrete transaction in one moment in time, and go off on their way. And they have no future relationship. They have no reputational sanctions that they may be utilizing as a way of enforcing their agreement, but what they have instead is a piece of paper that they've negotiated freely, that they've bargained over completely, and they've specified everything that's supposed to happen, and then if something goes awry, they go to the court, and the court simply reads the contract and enforces the agreement between the two parties. What relational contract theory has tried to do is complicate that picture in many different ways. The one of interest for me in this book is focusing on the way in which most contracts in the real world arise among parties who have some kind of either pre-existing or ongoing relationship, right? And that the relationship itself serves as a way of filling in a lot of detail of what the real agreement is between the parties. So if you have a discrete transaction, you walk into, your car breaks down when you're in Humboldt County, and you're never going to go to Humboldt County again. You go into a garage. You deal with someone there you're never going to deal with again. You barely remember what name the repair shop has. They fix your car. You go on your way. Everything about the repair is pretty much going to be specified up front. You're not going to have an ongoing relationship with the individual. They're not worried you're going to blog about their particular, although in today's world, even these discrete transactions don't feel so discrete because we always have access to affecting reputational sanctions on people through Twitter and through various way or Yelp or what have you. But in any event, the old model was you had to specify everything up front because there was nothing in your ongoing relationship that could actually clarify any detail about what was your real deal. You just had a paper deal. By contrast, relational contract theory invites us to think about all of the implicit ideas and dimensions of the relationship that supply information and terms about what the real deal between the parties is. So if you have two companies that have been they have existed for generations in a certain kind of cooperative venture. One supplies gas, the other buys gas, and they just like have lived together in this domain for years. The individual renewals of their agreements may not be highly specified, and indeed Their course of performance over time, their course of dealing over the course of many transactions may ultimately be specifying more of what their real deal is than whatever little piece of paper the two heads of the companies agreed to many years prior. Right, that is many different features of performance may have changed over time because of extrinsic conditions or what have you. And so the question that relational theory asks, at least on the question of what contract law ought to be, is what do we do in that context when a relationship breaks down? Right? What is the approach that the court is supposed to be taking? Is it supposed to be reparative and just try to figure out how to get these two parties back on track? So that was one idea from relational contract theory. We ought to keep these two parties together. The second thought is, well, we're stuck. They've broken up. They want a divorce. We have to figure out some way of distributing the goodies. Do we just look at the piece of paper they signed? Relational contract theory would say, no, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Their real deal is embedded within the relationship. And so something about the relationship ought to be giving us some indication about how to read that piece of paper on the one hand and how to supply new terms to that agreement on the other. So we could talk for another hour about relational contract theory, but that's just sort of, you know, that's the teaser. What any of this has to do with friendship, for a long time, relational contract theorists would describe these two companies engaged in this cooperative venture as parties who are engaged in a marriage. They are codependent. Their relationship is tied up with one another. They treat each other with special good faith. They engage in best efforts. They are two parties that are fundamentally engaged in cooperation. Okay, which we assume is going on in marriages. I'm not sure all marriages actually function that way, but anyway, that was the thought. It's an altruistic community of a certain kind. So my move at the end of the book is to say, mm-hmm. maybe relational contract theorists would do better if they considered those two companies as in a kind of friendship rather than a marriage. The advantage of thinking about it as friendship is I think friendship is already somewhat more complicated. I don't think altruism is the obvious organizing principle of friendship. It can be. I mean, those would be very, very close friendships. But most friendships have some dimension of instrumentalized reasoning, just some. I mean, I think that the view friends are always perfectly altruistic with each other is overly simplistic. Well, the advantage that you gain by reconceptualizing relational contract as friendship, though, is you start to see that it no longer really makes sense to adopt the view that you want to keep these parties together come what may. I mean, I think that this was an approach to marriage at some point. We just want to keep these parties together and not, you know, make it somewhat difficult for them to divorce. I think within friendship, we want to enable people to walk away if they want. What makes it voluntary, in part, is the ability you have to walk away from it. And so we want to be able to parcel contract law in a way that allows parties to break up when they want to. But I think it does also reinforce some of these basic ideas about not wanting to allow people to engage in predation, not wanting to allow people to engage in exploitation, underwriting some of the good faith obligations we think of in neoclassical contract law, underwriting the demand for best efforts in the pursuit of the joint enterprise. So, it's a much more theoretical project by the end to try to reimagine what relational contract would look like if we thought of relational contracts as friendships.
Well, and that gets really to, I think, what is a good closing question in the remaining 5 or so minutes that we have. To the extent that policymakers should be thinking about a particular area or policy proposal through the lens of friendship and are not, what would it be? What would you want to see as far as the first impact of thinking in these terms on policy? Where should friendship as a legal construct insert itself, perhaps where it isn't, or where policymakers haven't thought about the issue in the context of friendship?
It's hard to ask me to pick one thing. I mean, the book is littered with them.
Sure.
But I think maybe the most salient one that I think provokes the least outrage to start there set the bar pretty low. But right, so the Family Medical Leave Act is a federal act, forces employers to allow people to take time off to take care of ailing family members. And it strikes me that there's no particular reason why we ought to limit this perk that we force on employers to family members. So this is one area where I think we've kind of overvalued family for no particular reason. If you have a sick friend, say that sick friend has no family, or say you have no family, so you're not going to be taking off to take care of your sick mother and your sick father and your sick sister and your sick friend, right? You know, you could limit it so that people are only allowed to do this for a certain class of people, up to them who they want to prioritize. But it strikes me as absolutely no reason why you wouldn't want to allow friends to take care of ailing counterparts. We know from all medical evidence available to us that friends do better to keep each other alive than family members do. And so, you know, one can say, family is really easy to administer, but it's not actually quite so easy to administer, and there's no particular reason why an individual who wants to take their Family and Medical Leave Act time off to take care of a friend ought not have the right to do so. It's a small way of expressing the value that our society places in helping taking care of your friends. Now, this is also a great area where you could see the people who oppose it would say something like, we don't want that. I mean, we want you to have to take off work and not be paid. You know, we would want you to have to be really believed in this in friendship. Then what you'll do is take the time off anyway, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, you don't have a federal act accommodating it. Okay. I mean, but I just don't find that terribly persuasive. I find that what our public institutions are supposed to be projecting is a kind of we are supposed to be able to resonate with the kinds of values that are being expressed by our public institutions. It seems to me a very small way, but a very powerful way of saying that friends matter too. And a life spent committed to your friends will allow you to take off a couple of days from work to be able to help your friend die with dignity. And that strikes me as, you know, small potatoes, but potentially quite important.
And I guess, Ethan, you have begged the question, if that's the easy case, what's the harder case that you'd like to see happen?
So I think the harder cases are ones where I envision imposing duties. So that would let's call what I just proposed with the Family and Medical Leave Act a privilege of friendship. All right, so the harder case on the privilege side would be something like literally a testimonial privilege, right? So certain kinds of marital communications are essentially immunized from discovery, right? In cases, you've heard that a spouse can get up and say, "Look, I'm not going to tell you anything that my spouse said because it's a privileged communication." So the more radical idea would be something like, among closest friends, we ought to have some kind of testimonial privilege that protects those kinds of communications. If what we value is the privacy of friendship, or for those that are interested in the private sphere, right? For those who don't want the public institutions to violate the private sphere, why is it that we are okay with prosecutors being able to garner information about friends from their counterparts? Right. So pursuing Monica Lewinsky affair, right? What you had there was Ken Starr forcing friends to divulge confidences that were told within a friendship. Which you would not be allowed to do if it was within a marital relationship. And I think that's more extreme because privileges already are sort of exceptions to the rule that we want the truth, right? And obviously privileges of that kind would protect information from the government. But maybe that's what you want. If you're so serious about this, the privacy of the private sphere, maybe you want to have certain kinds of privileges in that context. And something Sandy Levinson argued for generations ago, it did not get taken up at all. So I suspect that proposal may not be going anywhere. That's a hard case because it's first of all, it's difficult to administer,
right.
But secondarily, it does protect the truth from the criminal justice system, which I think is a much more serious cost to pursuing in this context. So that's a harder case on the privileges side. On the duty side, there I think that's where I'm getting the most kind of resistance. So the United States generally has an idea you don't need to engage in costless rescues. So if you see someone dying on the side of the street, you may go about your day and get to work on time. as most people seem to do in New York, right? So that's and the law allows that. It has no problem with that. Well, you might say, if you see your friend dying on the street, you really ought to engage in a causeless rescue, and we're going to hold you liable if you don't. Now, you might say, well, duh, what kind of friend is not going to say, what kind of friendship is that where the person doesn't actually save their friend? So, that I mean, when would this ever arise? Well, bizarrely, it does arise. Hmm. And so those who teach torts teach a famous case called Farwell versus Keaton, which essentially involves a friend basically stranding another friend in a car in front of their grandparents' house and failing to, you know, call a doctor and failing to let the grandparents know, and the guy dies in the car as his friend just walks away. Now, they were probably drinking. It was they engaged in some kind of fight. But the court does hold you were engaged in a certain kind of co-venture, and that social relationship that you had underwrites the liability that we're going to hold you to. And that doesn't strike me as insane. It doesn't strike me as overly intrusive. It doesn't strike me that that's going to deter friends at the extreme. But it's yet another way to say, no, you know, friends have a duty of care to one another that is serious and that is legally enforceable. It doesn't mean always. Okay, but it does mean that sometimes if you've crossed a line within your friendship relationship, we're going to hold you liable for that breach. Now, we're not the lawsuit, the cause of action is not because you were a bad friend. Breach of friendship is not a cause of action, but the cause of action is related to the friendship. Just like a breach of contract in between two strangers who have no obligations to one another, going back to the relational contract idea. Two parties barely know each other, and one is holding on to a completely formalistic reading of a form contract, and the other is saying, no, come on. I mean, didn't we have an understanding here? Right? So you might say, no, in those cases, you go with the form contract. They didn't know each other. They had no reason to believe in each other's good faith. By contrast, if those two parties, the same breach of contract action, but now between two close friends, and their relationship was such that one friend said to the other, just sign the form contract. Obviously, I'm going to treat you better. We're close friends. These cases, by the way, exist.
Right? Sure.
It would not be unreasonable, at least by my lights, for a court to say, no, that friendship tells us that the form contract was not meant to be enforceable, but what we really should be enforcing is the real deal between these two friends. Right, one friend used friendship as a way of getting that party to sign that form contract. So we should not use fancy legal tricks to now bind those parties to the form contract. Instead, we ought to say, no, their real deal prevails, and the friend wins. So, I mean, those are much more controversial. I mean, I can, mm-hmm. I know an argument for why that would be wrong. We don't have time to go through it ad nauseum. But those are the sort of more that's a feel for the more controversial cases.
And I think it's a good way to close our discussion, because I think again in framing a book as friend versus friend, raising these contexts and these unusual scenarios, although as you point out the cases exist, is a good way to think about these issues, and ultimately a good way to think about the book itself. Professor Ethan Lieb, author of the book Friend versus Friend: The Transformation of Friendship and What the Law Can Do About It. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I've enjoyed the discussion. I look forward to having you back on the show if you'd like down the road. But thanks for taking the time today to chat with my listeners.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture. Among them are Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University discussing privacy and context, Dean Saul Levmore and Professor Martha Nussbaum of the University of Chicago Law School, co-editors of the book The Offense of Internet, Professor George Contreras of American University Washington College of Law, and Baron Zoka of Tech Freedom, co-editor of the book The Next Digital Decade. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to the show. You can listen live on KZSU Thursdays at 3 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also get the show by podcast by going to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, the iTunes page for the center, as well as hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. Email me if you have any questions at dave@hearsayculture.com or any feedback, and have a great day.